Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Today, I have with me Dr. Philip Gooding. He is a postdoctoral fellow in the Indian Ocean World Center and a course lecturer at the Department of History and Classical Studies at McGill University. He wrote his PhD in the Department of History at University of London in 2017. He is the author of several publications, of which is the monograph On the Frontiers of the Indian Ocean World, A History of Lake Tanganyika. It is the first interdisciplinary history of the lake and of Eastern African relationship with the wider Indian Ocean world during the 19th century. I'm honored to have him talk to me today here about this book. Hi, Dr. Gooding. How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you very much for inviting me to discuss my work, and thank you very much for engaging with it.
As always, I'd like to start with the genesis of this book. How did this book come to be? What were some initial ideas when you started writing this book?
So this book stems from my PhD thesis. So I started it well over a decade now, in theory, but of course, going through the PhD process, and then which requires lots of drafts, and then turning in the PhD into a book means it's had many iterations. One thing that stayed remarkably consistent throughout the whole process, however, was the idea that the frontier was going to be involved in it. And I don't know if this is particularly advisable to keep something that you had right at the outset as a conceptualizing term, if it's a good idea to have that the whole way through the whole process, but nevertheless, it managed to stick. This does not mean that my understanding of the frontier was constant throughout that. Indeed, it actually changed a lot. Initially, I set out to study the history of Lake Tanganyika in the 19th century as a frontier between African states during that same period. Scholars of African history will be well aware that most of studies focusing on the 19th century were written in the 1960s and 1970s. And now there are some exceptions here, particularly with the recent work into Buganda, which has grown significantly during the 2000s. But for areas of what are now present-day Tanzania and the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, and even Burundi and Zambia, which all border Lake Tanganyika, most of the work was written in the 1960s and 1970s. This, of course, was the period following African independence. And there's a lot of focus in this period of new African states on trying to understand the African states in the past as well. Do there's a kind of a broad research question that was kind of very interesting at this time was, can we use pre-colonial African states as a way of understanding post-colonial African states? Can we understand African nationalism by looking at pre-colonial periods? Which means that a lot of the work in the 1960s and 1970s focused on statehood. States such as Mirambo State, states such as Msiri State, and Yungu Yamawe, and also, of course, Buganda, which I mentioned before. Within this context, Lake Tanganyika was kind of forgotten. Lake Tanganyika didn't have developing forms of statehood around it during the 19th century. It was kind of what might be broadly referred to as a decentralized zone. So I sort of kind of wanted to fill the gap. Now, the idea of the frontier was very much inspired by the works of, for example, Igor Kopitov, but also by the growing scholarly work on borderlands, which has suggested that the edges of states, far from being peripheries away from the centers, are actually integral to political cultures. So kind of my first hypothesis was, how can an understanding of Lake Tanganyika help us to understand statehood in 19th century East Africa using a frontier borderland framework? Can Lake Tanganyika in some ways be seen as central to the understanding of, for example, Mirambo State or Msiri State or Nyungu Yamawe State? That was my first research question. And the answer to that, after having done some great deal of archival research in the London Missionary Society archives and the White Fathers archives and elsewhere, was actually, no, this doesn't work at all, which is a bit of a disappointment for me, particularly during my PhD thesis, and created a lot of anxiety. It just didn't seem to work. But so then, of course, you kind of move on to separate questions. So then I then kind of tried to understand what if we focus on Lake Tanganyika, what else does it contribute to? Not just think about the history of Lake Tanganyika, but where does it fit within a broader schema? Within this context, all interviews that I conducted with people on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, particularly in Burundi, in Bujumbura and Rumonge, and in Tanzania, particularly in Ujiji and Kigoma, really shaped what I was going to do next and where I was going to go and how an understanding of Lake Tanganyika helps us to understand the wider region. That is because so many of the themes that my interviewees want to discuss in answering questions that I pose to them challenged a lot of the assumptions that I'd made based on standard readings of the archive and to a certain degree on the historiography as well. Rather than on phenomena such as slavery and state building and Mirambo states, for example, and even violence, they wanted to discuss other phenomena such as Islam and kinship and marriage. And they directly challenged some of the central framings about ideas of slavery and bondage in Eastern Africa and what the characteristics of that slavery and bondage were. And when I thought about these and when I kind of really tried to, and then in trying to reconcile this, their discussions, the collective memories of the 19th century in these locations, reconciling that with the archival record, I found a lot of resonance in the themes and works of what had been studied in the wider Indian Ocean world. As I write in my book, that Islam has been absolutely fundamental to the understanding of the Indian Ocean world since Islam's founding in the 7th century. And also histories of bondage, which challenge standard kind of along the grain readings of European sources about slavery, have been prominent, particularly at my institution at the Indian Ocean World Center. And what I came to kind of realize was actually a really kind of interesting way of framing Lake Tanganyika was to kind of put it into, not just into conversation with the states that surrounded it, but actually in conversation with phenomena that transcend the wider Indian Ocean world. So something that kind of always kind of understood about the frontier was that this frontier is going to help me to understand not just Lake Tanganyika, but the areas around it. Originally, that was just very kind of an Africanist focus, but increasingly became an oceanist focus over time. And what I kind of came to realize, or kind of came to feel as though I wanted to argue and felt as though I could argue, that rather than being just on the edge of what you might consider the Indian Ocean world, which is commonly conceived of as only focusing on kind of the maritime and the littoral regions, actually, no, these inland regions can have an incredibly important part to play to how we understand the Indian Ocean and what we can conceive of as the world that encapsulates it. So then the ideas of, for example, bondage and slavery and Islam and how they spread to Lake Tanganyika shores, they became negotiated and reimagined in particularly robust and unexpected ways, ways that directly implicated populations who lived around Lake Tanganyika and populations who migrated to Lake Tanganyika as well, from not just the Indian Ocean coast, but from around the Great Lakes and the Congo rainforest as well. And so then, far from seeing it just as a periphery, I kind of see it as central to an understanding of how these broader themes that have been integral to Indian Ocean world studies have spread over time as well.
And then we'll come back to some of the themes that you have talked about, but before we get there, like all historical studies, this book writes about the lake in a specific period, which for you is the 19th century, more specifically in 1830 to 1890. And this book is, as you have stated, is about the lines of connection that developed between East Africa and the larger Indian Ocean world, and the role of the population in these connections. And if I'm understanding correctly, you're trying to say that these connections are building in the 19th century. And I wonder why you say that, because we have had historical studies that have taken back the connections in the Indian Ocean world farther, way farther back. So why 19th century?
So it's very much about, it's the 19th century for inland Africa. So the connections to the East African coast, direct connections to the East African coast with the Indian Ocean world have been, date back to antiquity, at least antiquity. The earliest known text, the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea, refers to East Africa as a region that is connected in a maritime sense as an exporting and importing region with the Arabian Peninsula and Western India. Now, over the long term, the Swahili coast, as the East African coast, was highly connected to the rest of the Indian Ocean world as a trading partner. The Swahili populations have regularly been conceived as middlemen in the trade between inland regions and maritime regions, inland regions of Africa and the maritime Indian Ocean world. The 19th century is distinct in some ways in that this is the first period where significant numbers of people inhabiting littoral regions of the Indian Ocean world head inland as well. And although traders from inland regions had been coming to coastal regions for a long time, the degree of the extent and number of people doing so increased markedly during that period as well. And particularly when you get as far as Lake Tanganyika as well. Now, that I've written elsewhere in a collaborative piece that's published in African Studies Quarterly, that there needs to be a lot more investigation into the extent of connection between deep inland regions and the coast before the 19th century. Up to now, it has largely been assumed on logical grounds that there's kind of a relay system that connected these inland regions that brought things like global commodities, for example, glass beads and the like, inland, kind of in stages, but not kind of one distinct trade route that individuals traveled on the full length of. It's kind of assumed on logical grounds based on environmental conditions, economic structures, the size of settlements, that is the case. But there hasn't been actually systemic kind of investigation into that. So there may have been kind of connection, there may have been some kind of direct connection between Lake Tanganyika and other deep inland regions in the coast and beforehand. But even if that was the case, even if there was that kind of long distance direct connection that that individual traders traveled the full length of, the numbers of people increased significantly during the 19th century. And this was driven by global demand for ivory in East Africa, particularly East African ivory, because of it, because of the large tusks, and because the tusks, the ivory of East African elephants was soft, which meant that it was less liable to split under the industrial process, which was going on in Northern Europe and the USA at this time. The global demand for ivory meant that the connections between Lake Tanganyika and other deep inland regions grew significantly during the 19th century. This is the major trigger for that process. And that's why I kind of focus on it. Now, this is notwithstanding, of course, that there have been longer term connections between the coast and the wider Indian world. And there's a possibility of a deeper antiquity to direct connections with the inland regions, but that is yet to be investigated yet.
Okay. And this book in some ways is the history of the Indian Ocean world through the frontier, which is the lake. If I can ask, why did you choose this particular area? I mean, you were talking about that you had been there and had conducted interviews there, but what motivated the choice of this region?
Of Lake Tanganyika specifically. Yeah, so the motivation behind the choice originally was kind of what I mentioned earlier. There's in the writing on 19th century East Africa, which was mostly written in the 1960s and 1970s, it was kind of missed off. Because and I kind of postulate, and this there might be multiple reasons, it was mostly missed. I think because it didn't really fit the paradigms of that period. It doesn't fit the themes of statehood. And also you can make the argument that that the historiography of the region is quite terra-centric. And this notwithstanding some very important works, not least by my PhD supervisor on Lake Victoria. So I kind of wanted to fill that gap, but it was also not, obviously you don't just want to fill a gap when you're doing something in terms of region, but there are other things that motivated it as well. One was very much that I thought that using the frontier framework, you could reshape how you understand East African history through an understanding of late, or particularly East African statehood through an understanding of Lake Tanganyika. And that's my first hypothesis. And although that didn't work, it still, I think this does reshape how we understand some aspects of East African history, particularly relationships between deep interior regions, particularly around the Great Lakes, and their connections, cultural productive and religious, between inland regions and the coast. But also the other one as well, trying to break out of this terracentrism. There's a little bit of that. I do cite Braudel as an influencing, Fernand Braudel as an influential figure. And his most famous work was on the Mediterranean and the Mediterranean world, for example. And I kind of wanted to see a kind of reflection on maritime studies. Not just from Braudel, but also since there's been this, the book itself is published in a series, the Cambridge Oceanic series, the Cambridge series on oceanic history. I kind of want to have a reflection on how kind of a world perspective and a maritime history perspective can help to understand a region in East Africa, and also just East African history more broadly. That's kind of the key motivating factors there.
And when you were talking about this in the book, you mentioned something very specific, which was that this lake was very important in 19th century Europeans, and they were writing about it. There's an amusing example that certain Europeans believed that it was the source of River Nile, but later this interest somehow disappears. Do you have an hypothesis why this happens?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a number of things going on. So, of course, the Lake Tanganyika isn't the source of the Nile. And by the 18, 70s is conclusively determined by Europeans that, so Europeans themselves, despite the kind of the problems with that kind of framing, have worked out that the that actually Lake Victoria is the source of the Nile, and now we know there's other kind of rivers feeding into the Nile, so that kind of, I think they kind of acknowledge that the source of the Nile is now in Burundi, but that's neither here nor there, really. So the Lake Tanganyika's declining importance kind of in the European mind occurs in the early colonial period, from the 1890s, really. But it's really, really, really kind of entrenched after the First World War. So in the German colonial, so when the German colonial administration in what is now mainland Tanzania, so they called German East Africa, which then later became Tanganyika, the name of the colony, under the League of Nations mandate. So under the German period in German East Africa, Lake Tanganyika was originally seen as very important. They even built a railway from Dar es Salaam all the way to Kigoma, which is just outside Ujiji, which was the most important commercial center in 19th century East Africa. And they consider this kind of important for linking the whole of the colony in terms of shipping goods, and also for not ship for transporting goods across the colony, and also for transporting labor across the colony, particularly from taking from western regions of Germany, East Africa, all the way to the coastal regions for plantations. Now, when this never really came to fruition, the railway itself was only really completed I think it was in 1914 even, but it might have been sometime between 1912 and 1914. I think it reached Tabora in 1912, and then it was only got to Kigoma in 1914. But I'd have to check that, and some listeners may have some ideas on that, would be maybe shouting into their earphones right now and saying, hold on, you've got something about the timeline wrong there. But it never really came to fruition. And when the British the British took over under the League of Nations mandate, they focused a lot more of their attention on the regions south of Lake Victoria in Usukuma. This area was seen as much more fertile, much more potentially economically productive. And at the same time, is much more densely populated. The western region around, and also the other factors as well, that the Usukuma had been quite Christianized by this stage, whereas Lake Tanganyika and particularly Kigoma and Ujiji still had significant populations of Muslims who were, I suppose, the town leaders of the time as well. So there's cultural factors, there's economic factors, and there's distance factors as well, I think, as well. And it's very much on the, and if you think about the geography of the colonial period as well, so Usukuma is on the border of Lake Victoria, which is also bordered by Uganda, which is a British protectorate, and British East Africa or Kenya, which is another British colony. So there's kind of a British zone there, which they're kind of focusing around. Whereas the much further to the west, and Lake Tanganyika, this at this point it really is seen as very much of the periphery in the British colonial eyes. As a result, it gets neglected and forgotten about, and it's just right on the very distant edge of the kind of their colonial imagination. And it just kind of, to a large degree, falls by the wayside in their imagination. And subsequently, as I said, gets neglected, which is kind of seen why it kind of decreases in importance kind of in the grand scheme of, I suppose, world and global history.
I found the second chapter of the book very interesting because you're discussing the changes in land use and the changes in climate, and a link in how this ends up expanding the emporia in the region. Why did you choose the changes in climate and thus agricultural patterns as a tool of analysis for talking about trade in this period? Is there something you came up with in the archives, or was this something that you were like looking for?
This is something that I came to very late in the day. This doesn't feature in my PhD thesis at all. And when I finished my PhD thesis, I can't imagine I was ever going to write what is essentially a climate history of I suppose Lake Tanganyika and climate's influence on the region's history. And actually, this is now shaping my research agenda presently, is thinking about climate and its role in East African history during the 19th century, not just around Lake Tanganyika, but particularly in some of those zones that I mentioned earlier, some of these major state zones, such as Mirambos, elsewhere in Nyamwezi, so west central Tanzania, and also in as far north as Buganda. But in any case, one of the things that kind of that I was trying to get to grips with, and I didn't do this in my PhD thesis at all, because in my PhD thesis, I conceptualized the era as the era of long-distance commerce. And this kind of implies that that long-distance commerce and trade was kind of the underpinning feature of the history of this period. And while trade was important, the expansion of ivory was important, the expansion of the ivory trade is important, as I've kind of really alluded to. This expansion of trade, this expansion of commerce over long distances was itself dependent on other factors. How do you feed? So in this period, the largest emporia, the largest kind of urban centers had about 20,000 people in, such as Tabora. Ujiji may have had around 10,000 people or 10,000 permanent settlements at one stage. And this is significantly larger than the kind of settlements beforehand, which would have been in the low hundreds. In addition, there are caravans passing through East Africa by the 1880s of up to around 3,000 people, just basically in a big moving city. Now, this is massively important in terms of commercial history, but it also implies it implies that there needs to be a shifting patterns of production. The key question is, if you're going to have massive urbanization on this scale, if you're going to have this number of people traversing the area, how do you feed them? How do they sustain themselves? And I wanted to kind of understand, firstly, well, how did they, and what pressures did this cause? Now, the two arguments that I make that how did you feed these urban centers, how did you feed these emporia, and how did you feed the people in these caravans came down to two things. One was labor, the mobilization of increasing numbers of enslaved laborers, which is obviously a very violent process. And the other one was through the adoption of imported crops in increasingly large quantities, particularly maize and rice. Now, maize is a New World crop, which probably found its way onto the East African coast and just immediate hinterland in around the 16th century. The rice had been on the coastal regions from around the 9th or 10th centuries. But they don't seem to have made the way significantly inland until the 19th century. That is, with the expansion of direct trade links or sustained direct trade links between the coast and the interior. Now, the reason that maize and rice are so important is because they are so much have so much higher potential yield than sorghum and millet, which are the East African staples that farmers tended to grow beforehand. And therefore, theoretically, if you replace some of your sorghum and millet fields with rice or maize fields, you'll therefore have the potential to grow significantly more grain, which can therefore feed a larger population center or feed caravans as well, provided there's kind of commercial negotiations going on here too. So that's kind of the hypothesis here, and that builds out, and the evidence is there to support this. And many of the emporia, the urban centers around Lake Tanganyika, were notable for the availability of maize and rice in them, particularly around Ujiji around the south of the lake at Liendwe. The problem or the challenge of maize and rice, however, as I discovered, is that while they have a higher potential yield, they produce significantly lower yields in years of drought compared to sorghum and millet. So what the process is going on here is that by growing more maize and rice, farmers were bringing more potential to their yield, bringing more potential to their agricultural regimes, but at the same time, bring more risk as well. And then looking at a variety of sources, including the missionary sources, but also climatological ones, about the teleconnections between, for example, El Nino and East African rainfall, the effects of global warming, global cooling on East African rainfall. And of course, those are kind of, when you think about global warming, you obviously think about the present. So this is very much thinking about the present context was very much influencing, like the questions I was trying to ask to try and to find answers to for this study of East Africa. And I kind of found that in the middle of the 19th century, as all these urban centers, and that should be said, states were growing to their apex, it was a period of generally abundant rainfall, not just in East Africa, but also across the Indian Ocean world. The monsoons were generally regular in this period, but from about 1876, most notably with climate historians will be very familiar with Mike Davis's Late Victorian Holocausts, published in 2000 as an incredibly influential book, which started off by focusing on the 1877 to 78 El Nino event, which triggered, which contributed massive droughts in India and northern China especially. That from this point onwards, there was a sustained period of climatic instability in the Indian Ocean world. The monsoons became increasingly erratic. And you can identify through the missionary archive that actually there were significant variations in rainfall in East Africa as well, with significant droughts in 1876, 1879, 1883 to 4, and then although not around Lake Tanganyika, but in other regions in 1886, 87, and 88. These are some very, very, very serious droughts in East Africa, which you can see from missionary sources, but also from what you'd expect to be occurring in East African rainfall based on our knowledge of what phenomena such as El Nino and volcanism have done to the East African climate at this time. So when thinking about that, so when you think about what kind of fed these growing emporia, what was needed to make these emporia grow and to enable caravans to traverse East Africa, that is reliant partly on growing maize and rice, which require abundant rainfall. Then what happens if you take that abundant rainfall away, which occurred regularly in the late 1870s and throughout the 1880s, then that kind of inspired that kind of aspect of the history. So this is a long answer to a very simple question. I'm sorry for that. But yeah, it's very much the kind of answering that question is kind of understanding, trying to integrate some climatological sources which have grown significantly grown in quality and quantity significantly in the last few years because of concerns with global warming, trying to see how that influenced, and based on looking at the 19th century sources, like, and the ways that the agricultural regimes change in this period, like this clearly and must have had a significant impact on states and societies in Eastern Africa during this time.
And you have written in considerable detail about the valley and the Omani traders who were Swahili and the Omani traders who were very, very competitive for the control of the ivory trade. And when the colonial powers come, one or the other, they join with either of these factions in hope that they would then have the control of this trade. And how does the study of the emphasis on the lake region add further dynamics to how we understand this relationship between the Omanis and the Swahilis?
That's a very interesting question. I think I'm not so sure the Lake region in and of itself is particularly so important here. What I was able to do here is kind of build on some existing studies, particularly that of Thomas McDowell, who published his book just after I published my PhD thesis. And so his work kind of helped the kind of ruminations I had in my PhD thesis come to greater light. Is kind of trying to challenge the kind of the both the 19th century sources, the framing of the 19th century sources, and also some of the framing in some of the early historiography on East Africa from the 1960s and 1970s, which kind of dichotomized Arabs on the one hand and Africans. And I wanted to complicate that. And I do that a lot through looking at the cultural interactions between so-called Arabs and Africans. That's the kind of the major thrust of the second part of the book. But it's also to kind of complicate this notion of Arabs and who these Arabs were. In actual fact, and as McDowell argued in 2018, and I did my PhD thesis as well, is that this is not a Arabs as previously conceived by 19th century Europeans and some of the early historiography were not a unified group, and there are multiple factions between them. And for a lot of the period, and though not all of it, you might be able to divide two broad factions between those who trace their kinship links to Oman, which I've called Omanis, and those who did not, whose kinship links were solely to the East African coast, who are referred to as Swahilis. And I'm very open to those kind of characterizations, those kind of labels being challenged in the future. I think I'm a little bit uneasy with those kind of characterizations. I think they generally apply, and they to a certain degree reflect what my oral informants told me, and particularly in Ujiji when I was trying to discuss them, who the Arabs were and where they come from. And they said, oh, the Arabs were Omani and the coastal were not. The coastal populations were, oh, these aren't Arabs, these are different people. So I think they kind of reflect that. But I'm also very conscious of my role here as a white male scholar, trying to conceptualize different, I suppose, networks, factions, kinship groups in East Africa. And I'm worried that putting these labels might be, in some ways, be construed as re-tribalizing a group of people in Africa. So I'm very, very much open to that being challenged. And I hope that maybe some scholars may build on that or find new ways or better ways of thinking about it. In any case, in terms of the lake, the lake history, now how it contributes to it is the fact that so for McDowell, he only really traces it as far as Tabora, so to about three quarters of the way across present day Tanzania. I'm taking it much further, and he only does it to about the mid 19th century as well, particularly the late 1850s, early 1860s. I managed to take it further and kind of say that these factions kind of existed further inland, but also further in time as well. Just because the evidence is there. And this is probably where the lake kind of conditions really help with that, is the fact that there are so many different areas to look at, different emporia. So you could look at Ujiji, which is kind of the standard place to do, because that's the kind of the major political center, the major commercial center. But there are lots of other emporia as well. Mtoa on the banks of the Lukuga River, Rumonge in present-day Burundi, Uvira. Which means you kind of, by analyzing them all together, there are kind of comments from different missionary stations and different missionaries at all these different locales, but there's actually kind of an abundance of evidence for it. Whereas I think actually McDowell's work in 2018 kind of makes some of these statements quite tentatively. I think I can provide a lot more certainty to some of his conclusions based on the fact that a lot of what he observed in and around Tabora and in Nyamwezi there's a lot more evidence for kind of things he was tentatively discussing around Lake Tanganyika, just because there is an abundance of evidence for it. And this comes down kind of the fact that we've got so many emporia and so many kind of locales where these kind of competitions and debates are playing out. But yeah, this is probably the chapter in the whole book that I'm most uneasy with. And I think the one that I hope gets challenged and it gets footnoted, and maybe other scholars, particularly from the region, will have a better way of kind of understanding both the kinship links within the factions and also how we can characterize these factions, where they should be characterized as factions or as something else entirely. That would be something that I'd be really interested to hear about and to see research on moving forwards.
Coming forward to the discussion about the import of goods in East Africa, you mentioned three particular goods, and these are cloth, beads, and guns were coming all over the world into East Africa. Why particularly these three? I mean, it's an interesting choice, you know, cloth, beads, and guns.
Because these are the ones that circulated most widely, actually. The other ones I could have done would have been brass coils, particularly, because they're imported. But these are the ones that are just imported into East Africa so regularly. Those are the most abundance of evidence on. So the beads have been circulating, beads and cloth have been circulating in the Indian Ocean world for centuries. And there have been significant findings of beads in inland regions of East Africa that have kind of global origins from the deeper past, before the 19th century as well. And these kind of probably, we don't really know what they're used for. But in any case, they just grew because of the growing trading connections, they were significantly more widespread during the 19th century as well. And it simply is because these were the reason behind studying these three goods in particular was because these are the three that were just the most prominent, the ones that we have the most evidence for, and the ones that were most in demand. These are the ones that just made it to the region in the most significant numbers. Now the glass beads, as you kind of alluded to, I'll just give it a little bit more flavor, give a bit more of a flavor here for the listeners. Glass beads mostly came from Venice and from Hamburg. They had a variety. Richard Burton wrote of his experiences in the late 1850s that there are around 400 different types of beads circulating in inland East Africa at this time. They all had different worths, and those worths increased and decreased over time according to fashion and demand and their usage, as whether they're going to be used as currency or just simply as kind of a decoration. Cloths, meanwhile, cotton cloths particularly were imported from northwestern India and the United States and from Britain. And also some specialty cloths, some of the most high quality cloths were imported from Oman as well. And guns were mostly relics of the Napoleonic Wars. And kind of what I kind of make the argument for is that all of these cloths in all of these goods in different ways had distinct imprints on East Africa's material cultures. And this has been explored beforehand, particularly by Jeremy Prestholt, in his incredibly important work, Domesticating the World. But I suppose, and his argument is, and which I build on as well, is that East Africans didn't just accept these goods willy-nilly. They weren't just, see these as trinkets. They didn't see these as foreign imports. Oh, it's a foreign import, therefore we must have it. They had a great deal of agency over which ones they wanted, and they chose which ones they wanted, and this had a knock-on effect to markets around the world, particularly in Zanzibar but elsewhere. And the ways that they demanded these goods were not just based on their perceived value in the world market, but because of the way that they interpreted them based on their pre-existing and evolving material cultures. Now, kind of one of the things that I kind of add to this paradigm is also, it's not just that, that's affecting demand, but also a broader processes of cultural interaction. It's not just important how African material cultures developed on their own, but also the other influences they're being subjected to, or other influences that they're engaging with. Sorry, not subjected to. For instance, the cultural influence of coastal traders and their followers, particularly in terms of Islam, and the different social and kinship bonds that were developed through these broader cultural interactions. So that's kind of the point I'm trying to make here, is that the way we can understand and conceptualize the introduction of beads, cloths, and guns in East Africa in the 19th century is not just in terms of a domestication of these global commodities into local settings, but also part of a broader understanding of cultural interactions between local and ostensibly global structures such as Islam.
Yeah. In this book, you have said the antonyms bonded and free are not very helpful when you want to analytically analyze the various kind of bondages that existed in East Africa. Why do you say that? And for a person who would be interested in this topic, what terms or notion do you recommend for them to look for?
This is something that I'm still wrestling with, and I'm hoping to produce something shortly related to it that has kind of a more generalist audience. And so maybe I'll try out some of that now. And maybe I'd be very interested if listeners have some comments, and please feel free to get in touch with me if you do. Now, this idea that slave and free have limited analytical utility as conceptualizing terms has grown in prominence in Indian Ocean world studies in recent years, particularly through the work of Gwyn Campbell at the Indian Ocean World Center, but also others. I think Suzanne Myers beforehand was very involved with this, and also some of the older historiography from African studies. And here I refer to Suzanne Myers and Igor Kopitov's seminal and incredibly important, and I think sometimes overlooked volumes, and from the 1970s, I think it's called, it might just be called Slavery in Africa. If that's not the title of the book, it's the title of the introductory chapter. But in any case, the key point that I want to draw out here is that the sources, the documentary sources, or the authors of the documentary sources, so that's European so-called explorers and missionaries, basically use the term slave to describe anybody who they didn't recognize as being in free wage labor. This meant that sometimes, as Stephen Wockel has shown us, they actually called some people who were free wage laborers slaves. But kind of I take that even further and say that some of the people that they refer to as slaves did not see themselves as slaves, and neither did their so-called masters. But this doesn't mean that they were free also. It just meant that actually there were forms of bondage that were between these slave and free binary. And in actual fact, in many situations, including on the shores of late 19th century Lake Tanganyika, and I think elsewhere in the wider Great Lakes region, being bonded was preferable. Being bonded, in this context, the concept of being bonded is very blurred with the idea of kinship, that to be bonded to someone gave you access to some kind of social prestige, gave you access to, particularly in terms for men, access to credit, which enabled them to trade on their, I suppose, patrons' behalf. And also, if they have access to credit, this gave them access to forms of personhood and prestige and goods, things like guns and expensive cloths, which were ostensibly marked out prestigious status. Now, the European missionaries, the European so-called explorers, referred to these people who had the most who had guns, other markers of social prestige, had access to credit, because they're in some kind of form of bondage, sometimes in terms of debt, because of the nature of credit, referred to them as slaves because they didn't have entire control of their labor. I haven't made the point in the book that I'm in the process of developing a paper on this, and that this is kind of reflects more their kind of position at the authors of documentary sources, their position as ardent abolitionists, as trying to identify slavery, trying to see slavery as a kind of a raison d'être of being there in the region to in their mind liberate Africa from slavery, that they identify it everywhere and fail to understand the blurred boundaries between bondage and kinship in the regions that they see. So yes, in terms of why this limited analytical, if you the idea that slave and free limited analytical utility is because, yes, if you have a broad definition of slavery and define it in terms of entirely by conditions of labor and the obligations as laborers, you may be able to refer to all of these people of varying social categories as slaves. But to do so, you kind of have a very much a Eurocentric discourse that privileges the language of 19th century abolitionists over the people in East Africa at the time who were experienced these conditions. And at the same time, you overlook that the people these people who are ostensibly enslaved did not seek freedom, at least not in the terms of how missionaries and European so-called explorers understood the term, that they could be free to sell their labor how they wanted. This is not desirable. If they were free to sell their labor, they would not have a connection, whether you consider that kind of form of bondage or a form of kinship, with a potential patron who could give them access to credit, or in the case of others, access to prestigious goods, or just kinship in general. So to impose the idea of slavery and freedom on this condition, on these kind of to impose this idea of slavery and freedom onto these conditions is to, again, as I said, privilege the language of abolitionists, but it's also to privilege the language of imperialists who then co-opted this kind of discourse as a means to justify morally partition and subsequent global colonial rule, the broad conception of the civilizing mission, which is partly underpinned by the desire to end what they described as slavery. Now, I think so that's why it's not just that their limited analytical utility, which is the kind of point that I make in East Africa, because in my book, because it doesn't reflect the conditions. I also think, and this is kind of where the next part of the research is going, maybe it will see the light of day sometime in the future, is that actually it's privileging very problematic discourses that have their roots in 19th century Eurocentric paradigms over actually the lived experiences of people in East Africa during the 19th century.
Yeah. And since we are almost at the end of the podcast, I always ask this question, what do you hope the readers take from this book?
Several things, I think. I think there are a few things. All right. We will begin with the first is I hope that the interdisciplinary nature is really valued. The fact that I was able to use climatological sources, archaeological sources, and oral sources, which really, I think, challenge the archive in the way the archive has been used up to this point, I think adds significant layers to what we can understand about East African history. And I hope that is kind of seen by some as inspiring or as a new way of understanding the new ways to understand other parts of the region's history. I also hope that cultural histories of East Africa become more, is something that, so this is primarily a cultural history about cultural interaction. And this, like, scholars have written beforehand, historians have written beforehand, and this I cite an influential article by Richard Reed. He kind of summed this up in the Journal of African History in his article Past and Presentism, that many scholars of East Africa, many scholars of African history have kind of seen like culture as to be, or cultural history to be impossible because of the lack of sources for pre-colonial, in the pre-colonial eras. And I hope that I've demonstrated that that's false. And actually that there are a lot of, that through critical reading of the sources, engaging in interdisciplinary methods, you can actually get this kind of cultural history that I think is incredibly important for how we understand the region. And the other thing that I really hope that scholars get from it is in terms of Africa's relationship with the wider Indian Ocean world. The Indian Ocean world historiography is really coming its own. It is really, I don't want to give kind of an overview of Indian Ocean world history, or at least my understanding of it here, or its historiography. But it was really gained steam in the 1980s, particularly with the work with K.N. Chowdhury, who wrote a fantastic book, Trade and Civilization in the Indian Ocean. But one of the things that really permeated this early historiography was that Africa just got left out, and that the Indian Ocean forgot that the whole western border of the Indian Ocean is Africa, and is kind of looking at Asian connections, which went to Middle East and then possibly into the Mediterranean. And also, of course, it went into Southeast Asia and possibly all the way around into China. Africa's kind of missed off of that. Historians have gone to challenge that since, integrating the particularly the Swahili coast into understanding the Indian Ocean. And that is really integrated into it now. Now, what I hope my book does is show that actually we can take these connections further inland. And actually the inland regions could be absolutely integral to how we conceive of not just Africa's connection with the Indian Ocean world, but also the Indian Ocean world in general, and the other inland regions from kind of like inland India, inland China, that we can kind of explore in the context of the Indian Ocean world as well. And I can do this on, you can do this on climatological terms or environmental terms by looking at the influence of the monsoon system, but you can also do it on commercial, kinship and cultural terms through the migrations of people, of traders, and with the movement of goods as well. And I think the thing that I really hope about the book, one of the things that I really hope resonates with people is the way I finish the book in this context, with the epilogue. And the epilogue kind of refers not very much Lake Tanganyika at all, actually. Is actually the epilogue focuses on some fairly well-known riots in coastal towns in 1888, which then led on to the Abushiri rebellion, which lasted until 1890. And these have been studied in depth, most notably by the work of Jonathan Glassman in the mid-1990s. And these are, and what I wanted to do with this was to show that you can't just understand this coastal history or this history just as something that's isolated at the coast. Actually, what if you really want to understand it, what you should really be on, what we're thinking about as well, is also the connections that the coast has with inland regions as well, including around Lake Tanganyika. And actually, what I hope that this shows is that for understanding the coast history, for understanding the littoral regions of the Indian Ocean world's history, you need to incorporate these inland connections as well. And again, I referred to it earlier, my article co-written with Jonathan Waltz in African Studies Quarterly, kind of really stands out as a call that we need to think across this dividing line in East African history and Indian Ocean world history more generally between littoral regions and inland regions. In actual fact, there are connections between the two, and this kind of dividing line that we've kind of imposed isn't particularly useful. And yeah, and I really hope that my book is seen as someone that seen as one that really shows this, and I hope that other scholars will take up this mantle as well and think about the Indian Ocean world or coastal histories that engage with the inland regions much more than they have to this point.
And what are you working on right now? What can we hope to read from you in the future?
So a couple of things I've kind of alluded to them a little bit in this text. One of those is kind of the more general work on the usage and utility and problems of the idea of slavery and freedom in African history, though paying particular attention to East African history. And we'll see if that comes to anything. I presented a version of it at a conference last year, and I've got a few more dates with it coming up. And we'll see if that ever gets fully written up and put out there. We'll see. But the bigger project, again, I referred to it, is on the climate history of East Africa. And I'm focusing on the period 1750 to 1900. And there are two strands to this project, which is funded at the moment by a grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. The first is a historical climatological aspect, which is attempting to construct a time series of rainfall for the period 1750 to 1900. At the moment, we're trying to do a seasonal time series, but that's quite high resolution, high temporal resolution. For the deeper past, we'll probably have to reduce the resolution just to get anything that's valid. And that's being done, and I'm doing that in conjunction with some climatologist colleagues at the Centre for World Environmental History at the University of Sussex. And we're incorporating historical documents as evidence, using as evidence for periods of drought, regular rainfall, and overly abundant rainfall, and also putting that in conversation with climatological sources, some of those which are taken from the region, like from natural proxies like lake sediments, but also from global climatic reconstructions, which reconstruct the climate of the globe at various temporal scales. So this is kind of trying to construct an interdisciplinary time series, or a time series for seasonal rainfall in East Africa from about 1750 to 1900, using interdisciplinary sources and methodologies ranging from climatological sources to historical sources, and then using both of our kind of disciplinary training in climatology and history to integrate them in a meaningful way. So that's the first aspect of it. And the second aspect of it is, once this time series is created, is starting to understand like how important, or in what ways was fluctuating levels of rainfall important for our understanding of East African history. Now, I've produced a couple of articles on this already, which are already out there. There's one in the International Journal of African Historical Studies, which is entitled Climate Change and Political Instability in Equatorial Eastern Africa, 1876 to 1884, which kind of analyzes a change from generally wet conditions to generally dry conditions, and its influence on statehood in East Africa, with particular reference to Mirambo State and to Buganda. And I kind of make the broad argument that in both instances, during the wet period, the phenomena that these states, or the developments these states undertook to take advantage of these wet conditions, undermined their resilience, the state's resilience to periods of drought, which then set in from 1876 to 1884, which then undermined the states and contributed to their gradual collapse, Mirambo's in 1884, or to Buganda in 1888. Now I'm going to try to make that a much more broader argument, a lot more granular, starting in about 1750, which is the beginning of another dry period in East Africa, and taking it all the way up to the beginning of colonial rule. And yeah, this idea of focusing on the states this time is kind of what I'm really trying to, which will be the major focus, particularly, yeah, really analyzing how climate influenced these states. And in some ways, this is kind of a return to the historiography of the 1960s and 1970s, which also focused on these states, but now with access to a whole new climate archive and an appreciation of climate's potential impacts on these states, for understanding how they both rose in the mid-19th century and how they declined, just on the cusp of colonialism.
This sounds like a very fascinating project. Thank you for joining me today and taking the time out for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the invitation, as I said, and thank you for reading the book. That doesn't go, I don't take that for granted at all. I really appreciate it.